things from start to mold a new reality closer to the heart, closer to the heart. Blacksmith and the artist reflected in their art. They forged their creativity closer to the heart. Yes, closer to the heart. Philosophers and plowmen each must know.
Welcome to the New York Public Library.
Other banks go out of their way to make redeeming credit card rewards needlessly complicated. But Discover isn't like that. With Discover, you can redeem your rewards for cash in any amount at any time. Learn more at Discover.
Technical trouble right there with the music, because I am not a DJ, but what I am is a very happy person to be here. Hello, everyone, and welcome to another webinar here at the New York Public Library's Business Center. Today, we have a fantastic series for you. We are kicking off our visibility series, where we're going to be talking about how creatives, entrepreneurs, and nonprofits are changing the way we understand human potential. And we're celebrating here at the library July as Disability Pride Month. So as a way of bringing together just the wonderful way in which uniquely abled persons are doing and improving business, we have a series of webinars that we are putting together throughout the month for you so that you can join us. And today, again, like I said, is the first one. So as I see you getting in, I am going to ask everyone to please just hold on for a second while I read to you just a little blurb that our legal department always asks me to read for you as we're getting started. And that just is, it's right here. And it just says that the library uses Zoom for this program, yet it does not own Zoom. Zoom has its own privacy policy that you can read on its own page, but Zoom also has closed captions if you need them. So simply go ahead and click on the CC button on your screen, and you'll find that CC wherever you see your your Zoom controls, whether at the top, at the bottom, or if you are in a smart device like a phone or an iPad, wherever those controls are, that's where you will find them. Also, to understand how you and the library use Zoom, please go ahead and read the library's privacy policy, especially the section that refers to third-party library service providers. Also, a friendly reminder that at the library programs, everyone is welcome and respected. And so with that, let me just go ahead and introduce our moderator for today. His name is Gustavo Serafini, and I have the absolute honor of calling him a dear friend. He is the host of the Enabled Disabled podcast, which is a podcast that was created for people with disabilities and their families, friends, clinicians, and therapists to shift the narrative around disability. And he has had great success because he speaks with his guests openly about what it means to have a disability as well, and this is very important, as what it doesn't mean. And his platform helps dive deeply into how the guests have experienced disability, what it has taught them about themselves, life, others, and the tools or experiences that have helped them better navigate and adapt to the world, what they wish other people knew about them, and what they're working on currently, and how they would like to improve the world. And by sharing all these stories, Gustavo hopes to influence thought leaders and companies so that they can empower people with a disability and the professionals who work with them. And if this were not enough, when he's not recording his podcast, Gustavo is a very successful entrepreneur. He co-founded Pure Audio Video along with his brother Marcelo in 2005, and they serve clients in South Florida, the Caribbean, and the US who are looking for amazing, and I really mean incredible, home entertainment experiences. So Gustavo, we are immensely lucky to have you here with you today. Thank you so much for being here. Thank you also to our guests whom you are about to introduce. So I will hand you the mic and the floor is all yours. Thank you, thank you, thank you.
Helena, thank you so much for the generous introduction. I really appreciate it. And thank you to the New York Public Library for making this happen. It's just a wonderful opportunity to be here, and we are thrilled. And I am absolutely delighted to introduce two people that I have a tremendous amount of respect for and are thought leaders and experts in their field. Julie Sawchuk is a best-selling author, professional speaker. She is a designated Rick Hansen Foundation accessibility professional. One of the things that I learned from getting to know Julie and working with her is she is also a tremendous problem solver. So if you go and see her YouTube videos, you read her blog and her writing, she's literally going to different businesses all around Canada, you know, wheeling in there and interviewing them live on YouTube and saying, look, this is a beautiful space. Let's figure out how we can make it more accessible. What if you did this? Have you thought about doing this in your bathroom? Her book, Building Better Bathrooms, is tremendous. So she's a phenomenal teacher, phenomenal speaker, and a great honor to be here. Jonathan White. Jonathan is the director of design consulting at the Center for Inclusive Design and Environmental Access at the University of Buffalo's School of Architecture and Planning. Jonathan is one of those rare human beings who has both a great sense of academic and what's going on at the forefront of all the research, and he also is a practitioner, and he helps different businesses, homeowners, cities all across the United States in making their spaces more accessible and implementing these great concepts of universal design that we're going to talk about today. So Jonathan and Julie, welcome.
Hello, and thank you. So fun to be here.
So we have read and seen maybe a lot of different information out there in the media. Some people talk about universal design. You've heard people say accessible design or human-centered design. So there's all these concepts that you may or may not be familiar with that are floating around on the internet. And we are here to talk about universal design. So Jonathan, I want to make sure that everybody's on the same page and that we have a solid framework for what universal design is. Can you take us through the definitions and the goals of universal design?
Sure, thanks. So yeah, there's a lot of different versions of what people think universal design is. One distinction that I think is the most important, it is not the same thing as accessible design. It's not the same as accessibility. Accessibility is minimum compliance with codes and standards, whereas universal design is bigger than that. Now, sometimes we go by the term inclusive design. We think it's the same thing. It's about this concept. So our definition is that universal design is a process that enables and empowers a diverse population by improving human performance, health and wellness, and social participation. In short, it makes life easier, healthier, and friendlier for all people. And to accompany this definition, we've developed 8 goals of universal design. And I'm going to share some images here with you now that help exemplify some of these goals. So the first goal of universal design is body fit, making sure that a design accommodates a wide range of body sizes and abilities. And so this image was at the Pittsburgh Children's Museum water play area where people of all sizes could dry off after water play. If you've ever taken a kid to someplace where they're playing with water, you know, everybody gets a little wet. And so, you know, we're not saying, you know, you need to put this in every bathroom, but what we're saying is you need to be thinking about different body sizes and abilities because everybody is a different size. And if you're designing for, you know, the average, you know, somebody might be average in one respect, but not be average in another. They might be average height, but not average weight. They might have an average length of their torso, but not average length of their arms, and so on. You know, body fit is really about this idea of anthropometry. The next goal is comfort, keeping the demands of the design within desirable limits of body function and perception. So it's not just about fitting, but it's about being comfortable in doing so. This is a picture of the Herman Miller Aeron chair. It comes in 3 different sizes, but then it has all sorts of additional adjustments within that for the arm height, the seat height, seat tilt, lumbar support, and the height of that, probably a few others as well. And so the idea here, you know, it's not just about, you know, making people feel like they're as comfortable as possible, but this could also help prevent, you know, repetitive stress injuries and that sort of thing as well, and make people want to come back to a space. And I'll talk a little more about that later. The next goal is awareness, making sure that the design, your critical information for use can be perceived easily. This is an example from a hotel in Tokyo where they have tactile guide strips on the floor because when you're in a wide open lobby, if somebody has difficulty seeing or uses a cane to get around, wide open spaces are difficult because there's no wall to follow. And so this provides a way to find their way to the reception desk where then they can ask for assistance, you know, in finding their room or whatever it is that they need. So this is about the science of perception, making sure that people can know the information they need to know. And so whether it's making sure that a fire exit is clearly labeled, or making sure, you know, like I said, making sure people know how to get out in an emergency or be able to find the information that they need. The next goal is understanding, making sure that it's clear and intuitive, making sure the design is clear and intuitive. And so this example is from some of the newer subway cars in New York. Of course, this visual example would need to be accompanied by, an audible solution. But what's on the screen is a dynamic display that shows what the next stop is on the train, then the next 10 stops all in a row, and that updates as the train moves along. And then not only does it show the stop name, but also the connections for buses and other trains. And then it shows the stops towards the end of the line and the last stop. And so it's not just about, you know, if anybody's ever been on the New York subway before they had this, you had that big map with all the different colored lines intersecting each other and trying to figure out your stop. there might be a sign that says inbound or outbound, or labeled with just the last stop on the train. And you might know that I want to go to Manhattan, but, or I want to go to this particular stop, but not know, well, is that north of here? Is that south of here? You know, you don't know what the last stop on that line is necessarily, unless you're from there. And so this is a great way of making sure that people understand the system a lot better. Another example, this could be faucets that, you know, are intuitive and easy to use. Sometimes faucets got just one lever, and I've seen two kitchen sinks, you put them next to each other, they get the same lever. And while to pull forward is hot or backwards is cold, and then out to the right is on and off, and then the other one will be opposite. And so, you know, it really goes hand in hand with the last goal of perception. This is about cognition. So it's not just about seeing what needs to be seen or hearing or perceiving what needs to be perceived, but it's about then understanding what to do with that information. So those first four are all about the human performance, the improving human performance part of the definition. The next one is about wellness. And so again, another example from New York City where they're transforming streets. So this is about, you know, protection from hazards, safety, protection from hazards, avoidance of disease, avoidance of hazards. So in this case, in the road here, you know, making it safer for pedestrians, but also making it safer for alternate transportation. So you can actually get exercise or maybe choose to walk or bike or rollerblade in this case, and prevent, you know, help prevent disability, prevent, you know, things that happen that, you know, just naturally as humans get older, you know, sometimes people's knees start to hurt or other things. And just generally as a society, we don't get as much exercise as we should, because a lot of people work, you know, in an office or sitting down all day. They say sitting is the new smoking, right? And it can cause issues. So getting people out and active and making sure people stay active and lead active lives. Then moving on to the social participation improvement area of the goal, is social integration. Making sure that people, all groups of people, are treated with dignity and respect, that we're not segregating different people into, you know, this housing is for senior citizens, and this housing is, you know, for college students, and this is for low income over here, and this is for upper income here. Having a good diverse mix of people in a neighborhood helps make sure that the neighborhood can work well for everybody, because everybody's got different needs and interests. This is an example in Malmo, Sweden, of a housing complex that does just that. It's got shops down below, it has apartments above, has social services in some of these storefronts. And so people can get to what they need within close proximity. They don't need to own a car necessarily, because they live in a, you know, an area that's only housing and it's only for this income. They have to drive to get someplace. And it provides a nice gathering space for people, you know, of all ages and abilities to come out and gather. The next goal is personalization, providing opportunities for choice and the expression of individual preferences. A great example from the product design realm is the iPhone, or really any smartphone nowadays, but the iPhone pioneered this, taking, you know, what was, you know, used by a lot of times younger people, the cell phone. People were texting on their flip phones with those little buttons and pressing the button three times to get a certain letter. And you could get on the internet on those phones, but it wasn't very easy to use. And then Apple came up with this idea based on the Bento box, where you got this app store and you can choose which apps are on your phone and move them around and find what you need and let other people put apps on your phone. So now the phone could be used for, you know, a camera or, you know, for music recording or whatever else, you know, people needed to do with it for work or for fun. And lastly, cultural appropriateness is the last goal. Making sure that the design respects and reinforces the cultural and contextual values. This example is the Hippo water carrier. In this particular village, women in the village were responsible for going to get day's supply of water, but it was far away. And they had 5-gallon buckets. It was a low resource community. They had these 5-gallon buckets. They would go and have to carry water. And so that was pretty labor intensive, but it also meant that younger women and older women might not be able to actually do the task anymore. And so this idea was invented where they put the water right in this drum and they attach this to it and they could pull it behind them, right? So universal design might mean something different in different places. In some place where accessibility laws, the ADA doesn't exist, this is universal design. It brings healthy water back and helps all people feel like they're part of the community regardless of age. And it solves a needed problem. You know, grab bars next to the toilet and the distance from the toilet are the less important issue for them. So again, universal design, it's not about accessibility. It's about this process of improving, of always improving human performance, health and wellness, and social participation. Two last images I want to show here before I toss it back to you, Gustavo. So this is an image now. It looks like these are out of order. I gave it away. this is the Holocaust Museum in Washington, D.C., and they have this quiet, reflective space, but notice it's accessed by stairs. And they installed this lift so that everybody could access the space. And so this provides access. It provides a minimum level of access. And assuming that this lift meets, the code requirements, perhaps legal access as well. But the lift makes a lot of noise. It's stigmatizing. It doesn't look very nice in the space, to be honest. This is accessible design, but it's not universal design. Universal design would treat all groups equally. They would have designed the space entirely differently, for this space. And so I think this picture helps drive that point home. And that's what I have for now.
Well, I love that you showed those last two pictures, Jonathan, because that's a great point of if you had designed that space with universal design, the lift would have been incorporated, but it would have fit into the architecture and into the whole construction much, much better and more seamlessly so that it doesn't stand out as this is for people who are wheelchair users, right? So Julie— yeah.
Or it wouldn't have been there at all.
Or it wouldn't have been there at all, right?
You would have had no steps or some other way of getting down there.
Right, perfect. And I think there's a bunch of different takeaways here, but when I first learned about universal design, for me it was, not only is this great for architecture, for spaces, but this is a great design. This is a great tool for designing products, designing software, designing clothes, all sorts of things. My question, so for Julie, is when you first explain to people, right, you're going to a new business owner, and you're going in and you're explaining universal design, what are the typical reactions that you have seen from people that you're introducing this concept to?
Honestly, the very first thing that people want to know is how much it's going to cost. And that always seems to be the stopping point. This is going to cost me more money. And I try to dial that back, right? Like, let's not even talk about what we're going to do. Let's talk about why we want to do things differently from a universal perspective. Now, Jonathan, that was amazing. recap for me to have a much more clear picture of universal design versus accessibility, especially in those last two photos. And when I do that dial back of the why are we doing this, and I talk about making a space work for everybody and making your service work for everybody, then And I introduce numbers like, 20% of the Canadian population identifying as having a disability and needing things to be done differently than we have been traditionally doing them in terms of our built spaces, then they start to think. And honestly, another honesty is a lot of the people that I work with already recognize that they need to do things differently. And so there's not a whole lot of convincing that I have to do in my work because a lot of the people that I work with already know that they need to do things differently and they just want to know where to start. And that's super refreshing because when you come up against people who don't get it, it's hard. It's hard to get them to see that there is a whole bunch of people that they aren't able to, you know, feed in their restaurant because they have all high top tables, or they've got steps up to their bathrooms, and they haven't designed the space so that all features can be used by all people. And yeah, that, I don't know if that answers your question, but that's my beginning rambling. Oh, see, I got bathrooms in there the very first time I started speaking. Are you guys surprised by that? No. I was wondering how long it was going to take me.
But I mean, that's a great, so there's two interesting, really interesting things there. Is most of the people that you're talking to thankfully already get it or feel the need for it. Mm-hmm. But I like that you come back and you start with the why, right? So even for people who don't get it, starting with the why hopefully broadens their perspective and shows them, look, there's a wider world of people out here that you're not serving that you could be. And
yep.
At least in a new construction or a more substantial renovation, these things are very possible to accomplish. When you are looking at budgets, and this is a question for both you and Jonathan, when you're both looking at budgets, because I think it's important to talk about this, we'll talk about budgets and aesthetics. When you look at budgets from the beginning, right, how do you approach the budget conversation as it relates to designing a space using a universal design principle?
From the beginning, I think Jonathan is the person to answer that question. After the fact, I just wrote a case study about a little renovation in a bathroom in our local public library. And well, there's two examples. One's at a church, one's at a library. The library installed an adult size change table, and all in, the renovation was like $12,000. So, you know, that's a good chunk of money, but it's still doable. The church renovation was much less extensive and only cost $2,000. And now I'm talking from an accessibility perspective here, not from a universal design perspective, but there's a massive range, and there's a lot of research happening in with the CMHC, so the Canadian Mortgage and Housing Corporation in Canada here, where they can see that improving accessibility within a space and using universal design principles doesn't increase the cost of a new construction more than 1%. So you have to do all of these things to make all users able to, you know, access everything within a space and benefit from it and all of that. And it really is, it's just a flip of the mind to think outside the box. Jonathan, am I on point saying that universal design is a think outside the box kind of thing, right?
Yeah. And to think outside the box, I mean, there's the client side and then there's the design side, right? The designers are, you know, working for the clients, right? And they assume the client wants to spend as little as possible, but they also want a good design. And so, you know, it's cheaper, you know, even for the architect, or easier for the architect to just reuse the same designs or templates over and over, you know, than to think outside the box. Or they, you know, they're working there and they've got a certain deadline and they got to meet the deadline and get it done in a certain amount of time. They don't have time to research all this unless they have buy-in from the higher ups in the firm or design firm to say, no, go ahead and come up with a custom thing for these guys, or if that's the directive from the client as well. But I think you're 100% on in terms of, you know, that it's about thinking outside the box. And, you know, it's really not so much about cost, because like you said, that's the first question people ask, what will it cost? But we always say it's the wrong question, because the answer is always going to be, well, you get what you pay for. The more important question is one of value. With the economic benefit of adopting universal design, cost is important because projects have a budget, but there's priorities in every project as well. Not all of the client goals, user needs, or design elements have the same importance or quality, and it's all contextual. So these judgments of value, what do we value as a company, as an organization, as a design firm, what do we value? Let me share another image here. So this is an Olympic venue that's no longer being used. We've seen on television, you know, these cities that design these Olympic venues, and they spend a ton of money on them, and then they sit disused after the Olympics leave. And there, I'm sure there's examples in a lot of different cities too. There's one in here in Buffalo. We're going to spend $100 million on a new football stadium of state taxpayer money, right? These are examples where a lot of public money is being spent with at least questionable return, economic returns for the community. But they say, well, the public is valuing these things, or at least the elected politicians value them or think the public values them. And so they say, okay, well, we'll spend this money on that. And so like you said, you know, accessibility features cost under 1% of all new construction. And while universal design can add to that, because they're not mandated by law, you get to choose which features of universal design you're going to implement that have higher value for the owner and users. And you can choose solutions that give a lot of bang for the buck and support other non-universal design goals of the client and the end users. Look at, for example, a grocery store. Nobody questions having automatic doors in a grocery store, right? That's a universal design. It's not required by law. You can have pulled doors, even those push buttons. A lot of people think those are ADA required in the US, and they're not. But you know, nobody questions them in a grocery store because they benefit everyone. And there's direct economic benefits. They reduce the congestion at the entrances and reduce the need for staff to help customers, reduce accidents. And you can quantify all of this. But other times it's not so easy to quantify. You've got difficult decisions to make without, good information. Here's the other version that you might see. One of the examples I like to give is of a transit station. This is the new one in New York. And I haven't been here since they actually finished. It was all under construction when I last went there. So I don't know how good it is from a universal design perspective, not having been there. But a design team's making decisions about resources. What's the best investment? Can we increase levels of comfort and security? Maybe this more iconic form that's in the case of this image here. But having more comfort, more security, these universal design goals produce something what we call social capital. It can lead to increased ridership, increased revenue, greater support for future investments in public transit by showing that the agency cares about the user's experience. And this is often gets overlooked by both clients and designers when establishing these priorities. So it's important for, going into it to establish these are our priorities, these are our values, and not overlook this social capital things and not just look at the cost. I should also point out too that what I just said is a logical fallacy called a false choice, saying, oh, well, you can have this iconic form or comfort and security. Well, no, you could do both. A creative design team can do both. It doesn't necessarily have to increase cost. And so, universal design can be more expensive, but it can also be done in the same budget. So rather than talking about this, we're adding universal design. This is a new feature we're going to add to this. It's better to talk about having a good balance of priorities, increasing the value over the long term, and increasing investment in this social capital. And again, since there's no law that mandates it, you have a choice of what to include. I could go on, but I'll let you jump in.
No, I think I love what you both said, and I want to build on that. And I think that the additional issue is one of awareness. That the part of the big reason why we're having this discussion today and why we've done this kind of thing before in other venues is so many people still haven't even heard of what universal design is. So the more people are aware of it, it's the foundational principle of how you design a space, the more opportunity there is to contact experts around the country and around the world, like you both, to say, can you help me with this project? I just heard about this. This is amazing. I didn't even know it existed. So that's one of the big reasons why we're here today, is that sense of awareness. So my hope, and I think you both would agree with me, is the more people hear about it, the less resistance there's going to be to it, because they're actually going to understand the why.
Absolutely. And there is, it's a fear, right? This not understanding, not knowing what you don't know, and not even knowing where to start. Right. And so it applies to so much of what we do in our day-to-day lives. When you aren't sure, you don't even know where to start, right? And what questions to ask. I wanna I'm looking at the photos that I have chosen for today. And I wanted to start with this one. No, not that one. This one. Because I want to show my ideas of universal design in application, and also what is not universal design. So this is my example of what is universal design. This is a great, accessible, wonderful, wonderful hotel that I've stayed at in Ottawa. And I love how it's welcoming to everybody, whether you're standing or seated, and it's no like special little around the corner low service counter where somebody who's seated has to, you know, go around and be segregated from everybody else who's checking in. And the staff are also able to stand or sit, right? It works for everybody. And then I wanted to show you this example. This is at an airport, at you're waiting for your flight kind of place. And with the very first time I saw this, I was like, oh, cool, like a low height service counter. And then I was like, no, wait a second. I don't like this at all. From a universal design perspective, why didn't they just make it all lower height where everybody could sit in a lower seat? And these giant like blue wheelchair symbols on these chairs, it just makes me shake my head. I have no other words for it. It just makes me shake my head. And the funny thing is there's two chairs where they're supposed to be like wheelchair seating, and those chairs weigh like 100 pounds. And I couldn't even move the chair out of the way in order to roll into that space. So I had to get my friend to move that chair. So like from an example of what is universal design to what is not universal design, there's just some examples from the places where I end up taking lots of pictures. What works, what doesn't work.
Yep. I think it's also I want to shift back to, and thank you for showing those, Julia. I think the universe, the whole idea of that universal design principle is so that it's not a separation, it's included as part of the whole thing, right? And if we look at the picture that Jonathan showed earlier of the chair, right, the adjustable office chair, instead of having high tops or low tops, they could design something where the seats can go up and down, people can adjust to their comfort levels, maybe even the countertops can be adjusted too. That whole idea of different body fits for different people is really powerful.
I'm hijacking.
Yeah.
Because that's exactly the slide that I skipped over. That's exactly what this is. So when I put in this photo, I wanted to show you this particular product, which is the podium that I'm sitting behind. And this podium is height adjustable. So Samantha and I are here doing this presentation in the Ottawa International Airport, hence the big Canadian flags and celebration and everything. But this podium meant that I could actually be seated behind the podium, have my notes on the podium, and see the audience. And I didn't just have to put the notes in my lap and be beside the podium, which is what would happen with a standard height podium. And it meant that this podium could then come up to Samantha's height and she could put her iPad on it. as well. So that whole adjustability, it works for everybody. There's just another, happened to have it in my presentation.
Yeah, that's a great photo. And that really, the notion, Jonathan, if I'd love for you to take us through a little bit more of the value propositions and different case studies for universal design. But I think that whole, we talked about flipping of the mindset, mm-hmm. is we've been trained and we've been used to adapting to our environments, right? Our environments are, we think of these rooms and this furniture and these spaces as kind of static things, and we're adapting to them. So we're going to get a cushion to make a sofa feel more comfortable, or we're going to adjust the height of, you know, a toilet seat, et cetera. We have the power, their products exist now, the solutions are there, where we can make our environments more accessible, more adaptable to us and to a wider group of people.
Yeah, because when you don't use universal design, you have to go the route of accessibility, right? That when we don't design things with everybody and all needs incorporated into the plan, then we have to do these makeshift things like toilet seat lifts or whatever, right? Like, that's a really good way of looking at it, Gustavo. Mm-hmm.
And it's, you know, it's not really great design either, as we saw in the example at the beginning, you know, just having this lift added on, that doesn't look great, you know, either. And so I think a lot of people, when they conflate the two, they see that and they think that's what we're talking about. Like, we're gonna make it, you know, it's about wheelchair users or something like that. And, oh, we're going to have these ugly lifts everywhere or something like that.
These big blue ugly stickers.
Yeah, these big blue ugly stickers. And they think, oh, this would be terrible. And so that's the mindset we need to get away from, is that it's not about these blue stickers everywhere. You know, it's really in good design, you don't actually even see it. A good example is like whether you're pushing or pulling on a door. Everybody's had that experience where they walk up to the door and they think they're supposed to push and they pull or something like that, right? Well, a good design affordance, you wouldn't even make that mistake. You wouldn't even notice that door had a problem, because you would see, based on it's a push plate or it's a pull handle, and you would know what you're supposed to do at that door. So, you know, good design sort of goes unnoticed. It just comes naturally, that you don't notice what you have to do to use it. It just works. And so that's what's also tough, is that it's to point that out to folks. I think it's an easier thing to point out to left-handed people, because, you know, it just works for right-handed users. You know, you open that tape measure and the numbers are all the right way. And if you're left-handed, the numbers are all upside down. and, you know, it's an issue. But for a right-handed person, you just don't notice. So a good design, you wouldn't notice it, you know, either way. The numbers would be in both directions, no matter what, no matter how you open it, right?
Yeah, and I think that also highlights the second objection, right, that we often get with universal design, which is it's going to look ugly or it's going to look institutional. And again, the aesthetic is all about how well you design it, but there are plenty of products out there today that didn't exist 20 years ago that fit the need for the accessibility and look really good, and good design can keep it still looking beautiful. I mean, Julie, you've done, I highly recommend people go check out your videos, because you have great videos and pictures of your house, which is universally designed, from your kitchen to your bathroom. And you look at those places and you wouldn't know that there is, you know, you talk about your husband being, I think, 6'3" and right. And you're a wheelchair user, and it's a comfortable, wonderful place for both of you.
Yes. And I have another example to share. That's one of my favorite projects. And this is a restaurant and a brewery just down the road from me. And the owners, when they built this building 6 years ago, they had an architect who was very universally design minded in the construction. And there's a lot going here at the entrance of this building. It's got big pillars and a crosswalk that comes from the accessible parking with a tactile indicator and onto the sidewalk to the front doors. But there's some other things as well that you don't see. Well, you can actually see the little fountain as a cue for your, you know, you're coming to the main entrance if you have a visual impairment. And the other thing that you don't see is the heated sidewalk. And up here, not in Florida, where we have snow a good many months of the year, that is a helpful thing, not just from a safety perspective. It means that I don't track so much snow into the restaurant, and it is helpful to the staff, right? Because then they have to exert less effort in constantly going out and clearing the snow and making sure that it's safe. So just some more examples.
Yeah, let me...
But it doesn't have to look.
Yeah, let me go ahead and jump in there, because I was going to actually use the same example of... This is what it looks like when you do heated pavement.
That's awesome.
You know, because this ties into cost as well. Like you said, you know, you don't have to get a team out there to shovel the whole thing.
Yeah.
But you know, there's more to it than that as well. You know, you can quantify that, because you can say, well, what's the hourly wage of the people doing the shoveling or snow blowing or whatever it is? But there's lots of other things as well. What's the cost of people slipping and falling and suing? Oh, because you didn't shovel fast enough. I could make the same argument going back to New York City subway, because I know we had some questions talking about that a little bit too, but you know, having those doors at the transit platforms, which is, by the way, easier said than done, but still, you know, something like that. Okay, well, how much do these doors cost? How many people go over the tracks, either intentionally or unintentionally? And then how much money does the city pay out for that? And then emergency services and all of that. And then, you know, maybe, you know, somebody leaves a family behind and now that family has to go on public assistance. And there's all these other costs that could be associated with it too. But, you know, going back to the heated pavement, you know, there was a study done where there was this transit platform. I don't know if I've got a picture of that. There's the people shoveling snow. But there was a transit platform, and, they looked at, you know, the shoveling and all that, but some of the other things that they didn't think about was, okay, the salt, how much salt do we have to put out, and the environmental impact of the salt. And maybe you did think of the salt, you're forward thinking, you're thinking, okay, the salt, we got to factor that in that cost, and we're going to get that cost savings too. But guess what? The salt also pits the concrete and chips away the concrete, and now you've got holes popping out. So you're reducing the lifespan of the structure. A little more difficult to quantify. So this structure, how often is this concrete going to have to be repaired? How long will this structure last before we're going to have to rebuild a new one? Tougher to say, you know, it really depends. Maybe they're using way too much salt like they do here at the university here, where you're stepping and it's just crunching under your feet. You know, so there's the environmental impact, and then that the impact of having to replace the concrete more often as well. And so do I have the cost? I've got the doors. Just back to these. So
and that's a great connection, because I'm my background is actually environmental science, and sustainability has always been something in my teaching, and now I'm able to connect accessibility, universal design, and sustainability, because when you put universal design out there like that, Jonathan, and talk about the sustainability from an environmental perspective, you can start getting people to realize that those two things do work really well together. And when you design and build something from a universal design perspective, and do more than code, right? I talk about building beyond code, or using better practices or best practices. You actually, you know, create more longevity in that structure, because you've done forward thinking, and you've looked at ways of doing things that mean it's going to last for more people for longer.
Mm-hmm. You know, there's some questions coming in here. Like one of them is about, and I'm sure we'll get to questions at the end, but just to address one of these now, somebody's asking about disabilities that cannot be seen, and how universal design addresses that. You know, a lot of our examples, a lot of times, unfortunately, and this unfortunately contributes to the conflation between this and accessibility, they deal with wheelchair users because they have perhaps the most pressing space requirements, you know, in terms of turning or, you know, in the bathroom or whatever. And so that tends to be, you know, something that's more visible. But, you know, going back to those eight goals, when we talk about awareness, and understanding, let's say somebody's colorblind, making sure that you're picking out colors that are high contrast for signage and that sort of thing. Example, people who have PTSD or epilepsy, there's an issue about color choice and being able to see your surroundings. So there's lots of other design as well. And again, if it's good, you're not going to notice it, right? But for the person even the person who is colorblind might not notice that, oh, this sign has been specifically designed to make sure that I can read this. They only notice it when, oh, I can't read that sign. Same thing, PTSD, they won't have, anxiety or an episode. They'll just feel comfortable in the space, and which is how most other people would feel as well. So, it's you have to think of these things. And so when you're thinking of these 8 goals, you have to think of all of these different groups and make sure that you're designing, it's not just about making sure something is visible, but visible to everybody, people with low vision, people from the expected distance you need to view it from, people who might be colorblind. Same thing, comfort. It's not just about physical comfort, but feeling comfortable, feeling safe, feeling secure. We talk about design of bathrooms, and a lot of times we talk about designing gender inclusive bathrooms. Well, there are some people who have trauma backgrounds where they might not feel safe. So how are we designing the bathroom to make everybody feel safe, in bathrooms, if we're going to segregate them, making sure the doors go all the way to the floor and you can't see through the cracks in it and all of that stuff, and making sure, and guess what? Everybody likes that as well. Not just people who have a trauma background. Everybody doesn't want people seeing through that little crack or being able to, see under the door. And then you have to think of, well, what are the consequences of bringing the door to the floor? Well, there's a ventilation issue. Notifying that the door, that it's occupied, because you can't see their feet under there. So having that little sign, vacant, not vacant, or a light above the door, whether it's red or green. So there's lots of other considerations that we think about.
I mean, I think this really highlights, and we're getting close to starting Q&A here, but this really highlights how important it is to choose the design professionals that you're working with. I mean, you, Jonathan and Julie, are just this wealth of knowledge. You have the experience of thinking about these things that other people don't. And so it just highlights the importance of education and the importance of finding the people who can help you figure out what you don't know, so that you can go into a project as clear as possible about what your priorities are and who you're seeking to serve.
Yeah. And a lot of people, like design professionals, but anybody who's working and trying to get your business is going to say, we know. A lot of people think they know, or they might think they know what universal size is, but they're thinking about accessibility. Nobody wants to admit to the client, actually, I don't know what you're talking about. They want to get the job. So you have to say, well, I want you to, there's experts. I want you to consult with an expert who knows this stuff. Prove to me that you know this, what this is. Show me an example of a project you've done where you've accommodated this. And when they start talking about, well, here, we installed this wonderful lift in the Holocaust Museum, you can say, well, I don't know that that's what I'm talking about here. But if they start pulling out other examples, or they say, well, actually, we did this hospital for this disability services organization, and we, here's all the great features we added, and here's what we learned, and we've got this project guy. Well, maybe then they do know. That's an important thing, getting the right people and making sure they have them in, and having buy-in from, whoever it's for, right? If they're not going to, so some organizations some design firms have research arms too, where they actually will survey the employees of the old building and say, well, what do you need in the new building? What are the things that you don't like about this space that you could have better in the new space?
Understanding
the user, yeah.
Holy, that's just so very, very important. And Jonathan, I'm glad you brought up bathrooms again, because from a universal design perspective, that's a really great place to start, right? Like, who are using the bathrooms? What do they need so that they are comfortable and safe? And, mm-hmm. Something as straightforward as a recent project that I've been working on is a new McDonald's restaurant, and they have the men's washroom and the women's washroom and then the accessible washroom. And I'm like, okay, let's think about this. Why do we need to have a men's washroom and a women's washroom? If they're single seaters, let's just make them, you know, not sexed washrooms. So they're anybody washrooms. They've got a toilet on the sign, and this has a toilet and a wheelchair symbol on the sign so that people know that this is the washroom that is a little bit bigger and accommodates somebody who's using a wheelchair or whatever, or has a family or whatever. And just that whole copy paste, right? We can't just keep copying and pasting, because the way we have done things in the past, have we not learned that it doesn't always work, and we need to rethink it. So yes, choosing the right person to help you, the right people, the right team. I love that idea of researching researching by talking to the people who are in the old building, and what do they want to see in their new building? What are the deficiencies in their workspace or their, that they see for their clients? Yes, amazing.
There's a way you can actually save costs there too. I mean, you know, talking about this, the single user restrooms, like if you have a men's room and a women's room, guess what? They both need to be, they must be wheelchair accessible. They have to comply with the ADA here in the States. But if they're not gender segregated, then one of them doesn't actually have to be by law. You only need 50% if they're clustered in the same area. And so you could actually get away with having less space dedicated to the restroom. I'm not advocating for that, but like there is a cost savings that you can have by doing something like that. So, you know, cost, you know, it's the same thing with circulation space, right? Like you can usually make up for the space in some way. So if you had to increase the bathroom size here, and we say, you know what, for universal design, we want you to change that 60 inches to 67 or 72 inches. Oh no, that's an extra foot. It's only an extra foot in this bathroom, but maybe the other one doesn't need to have as much space anymore. You know, you can still provide some grab bars, but it doesn't need the full wheelchair clearance anymore, because legally you can do that now. So you can provide more space in one and less space in the other. So there are ways of making up for that, or having a more efficient circulation plan can, you know, not having these redundant circulation spaces that are all too narrow, have one wide space and rethink the plan that way.
I see that in houses a lot too. People houses that are attempting to design accessible houses, and they do all of these little passageways, and I'm like, you can't. Not gonna work.
Plans are great, you know, for that sort of thing. I see that all the time in housing, and it's, you could take the same. We've actually done in the book I did 10 years ago now, 12 years ago now, Inclusive Housing, a pattern book, talks about housing and how, you know, we took a whole bunch of houses that were typical stock plans from developers, and we redesigned them to be more inclusive. And we sometimes cut square footage from the home, keeping the same number of bathrooms, same number of bedrooms, but just having more efficient circulation and layout, you know, and not having these fussy features. And that's where it comes back to the idea of priorities and value, right? Like this one Victorian house we had this octagonal living room. Well, it's tough to put furniture in, and it created these weird spaces and weird turns and weird corners. We squared the whole thing off and reduce the square footage of the home and made it more usable while doing it. So it's about, again, it's about value and priorities and what's important.
Great. So I want to just do a very quick recap. There's so many takeaways to this, but I would like you both to add, let me know if I missed something, but I'm going to try to synthesize it into three huge takeaways, right? The first one is that universal design makes spaces better for more people, more types of people, different abilities, etc. The second key takeaway is that cost and aesthetics are no longer constraints for whether you do or you don't do universal design. And my third takeaway is find the experts in the field, educate yourselves, do the research, because what you don't know, and it's important to cover those blind spots and find the people who are going to help you with that and bring clarity to what you really want to prioritize in your project. So have I missed anything there, Julie or Jonathan, that you want to add?
The other thing I would add, just don't be afraid to ask questions. That is so important in everything. Yeah.
I would maybe just like to summarize the budget side of things a little bit more. You know, I talked a lot about, you know, how important is this to the mission of the organization, or, you know, the values, but also, you know, is it going to help reduce or retain or contain operating costs? What's the long-term costs and benefit? What's the social capital that will result from investment up front? You know, it's really easy in sustainability. I make it sound easy anyway in sustainability to say, well, you know what, these more expensive light bulbs or light fixtures are going to bring, you know, they're more expensive up front, but here's how your energy will reduce over time and you'll recoup the cost within X years. Unfortunately, with universal design, it's not so easy. And that's what I think scares some people, is how do you quantify that social capital? How do you quantify that somebody isn't going to sue because they slipped and fall, and, you know, that risk cost? It's not as black and white to be able to quantify that. So, but are you asking those questions, and are you asking them of the right people, and do you have the right people on board who can help you answer those questions? So, yeah.
Fantastic. Thank you. And Helena, can you, what's our first question?
Thank you. Well, Jonathan has already addressed the first one, which was, how does universal design account for disabilities that cannot be seen? So thank you so much, Jonathan, for answering that. And the second one is for Julie. Can you please elaborate on the 1% cost increase?
That was a study done by HCMA, which is an architecture firm in Vancouver, and they were looking at an office building. So designing an office building to code, to national building code here in Canada, code minimum, versus to the Rick Hansen Foundation accessibility certified gold standard. And so that's obviously way better than code and looks at all sorts of things that code doesn't look at. And what the research found was, office building to office building, NBC code to RHFAC gold, the cost increase was 1%.
Wonderful. Yeah. Thank you.
And so I would say it wouldn't even have to be that, right? Like, you could, if you saw that in planning, you could say, okay, well, maybe we can draw, you know, cut back and not save money in other areas. I've been in buildings where they had, you know, the company's logo was on the elevator buttons, right? Like, that was a decision that was made. It's kind of cool, right? But it is it necessary? You know, like, there's yeah. always little things like that that you could say, well, you know, maybe we could spend the money better elsewhere, right?
And I think that's a perfect segue for our next question that comes from Ms. Hurley. In this is they're talking about the pictures that you shared, and she says there are a lot of pictures of public places and big businesses, but are there any ideas or pictures for small businesses or mom and pop shops that you have that you can share?
Yeah, I don't have any images offhand to share, but yeah, we do this all the time for smaller businesses as well. I think that the problem comes in where you know, These larger companies tend to have like this big infrastructure in place. They have like diversity inclusion offices, right? And they have a person who's in charge of this. And so they have like some sort of initiative to go out. Whereas with the mom and pop, yeah, it's sort of on you. If you're just the owner, it's just the two of you, you know, it's just mom and pop. They have to, you know, do it themselves and go out and do it. But the same ideas that apply to these larger businesses can happen for smaller businesses. And actually it's easier if it's a smaller building. Wayfinding becomes a lot easier. You know, a lot of things become a lot easier. You don't have to have lots of different restrooms. Maybe there's not even an elevator anymore. So, you know, it's just one floor. So it can become easier, you know, at the smaller level, but it's so context specific that, you know, it's tough to generalize for, you know, a mom and pop store. These big office buildings, it's easier to generalize because, well, it's a big office with a bunch of stuff in it. Doesn't matter whether you're working for this company or that company, it's a big office with a bunch of desks and computers. And so it's easier to generalize and talk about than a mom and pop business. Well, if you're selling shoes versus your restaurant versus whatever, you know, there's a lot of different considerations there. But we have a website called thisisud.com, where we have a certification program similar to the Rick Hansen program. where we, you know, if you sign up for a free account, you can get a list of 500 solutions for, you know, universal design. And it, you know, you can pick and choose, you know, which solutions, you know, work for you based on the scale of your business, but it was designed to work for any size. You don't have to do everything on the list. You just can do the ones that apply to your organization based on the size.
I think that what you just said is fantastic, because that our audience is mainly small businesses. So I'm sure that they will find that really, really helpful. I just put on the chat, this is UD.com. I just wanted to confirm that's correct,
and
right?
This is UD.com, yeah.
Fabulous. Thank you. All right. Yeah. So the next question.
A lot of the little projects that I've worked on just in my own small town here, we're a town of 1,000 people. And so they are those mom and pop businesses right there, small and trying to just figure out ways to make things better for everybody that's trying to come and use their services.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Gustavo, do you have anything to add to that? I saw you nodding.
Oh, I mean, so I'm a small business owner too. We have 9 people now, and our store is accessible, or I should say our showroom, and we are remodeling it. Now that I know so much more than I knew 15 years ago, we are going to be making it even better, more welcoming, have some more universal design principles in place. But I think the main thing is to remember that a good design professional, whether that's an architect, an interior designer, builder, they're problem solvers. And if they don't know, they should know where to find those answers. So there are solutions for all different kinds of spaces. It's just about how creative are the people that you're working with, and can you find the right people to help you on that journey?
Absolutely. Thank you. Thank you. Now, the next question comes from Leslie. She gives us a yes, like an enthusiastic yay. Copy paste has to die. From your perspectives, what's the best way for an occupational therapist with an emphasis in environmental design to make themselves as marketable as possible to get hired for consulting?
Unfortunately, there's no certification program we're aware of, but I do run an online training program here at UB. Here's a different website for you. It's udeducation.org, where we have online courses that, you know, you can pick and choose what you want to take. Some of them you can just buy our textbook and just take the test, which, you know, you read it on your own pace and take the test, which is really meant for architects who just want the CEUs. You know, they can read the textbook and answer the questions and get the test. But then we also have ones that are more involved, where you've got videos in addition to the textbook, supplemental readings, projects that, you know, I will go in and answer. And so I would say we designed them initially for architects, but I would say half or a third to a half of the people taking them are OTs or PTs. So particularly we have a course on home modifications, which is where we get a lot of interest. And so I would say, you know, just get knowledgeable in those areas so you can know what you're talking about. And we do give you a certificate, you know, a little paper certificate that you can print off for each course you complete. It's not like a degree or anything, but it's something. So that's one way.
I would say spend time in spaces that are designed with universal design principles, because they feel different than regularly designed spaces. And, you know, so if you can visit a home that has been designed from that perspective, you will be able to then translate that to your clients as they are asking questions about, well, you know, if I'm going to be, you know, if I'm going to be losing my sight, how am I going to navigate in the kitchen? And, or if I'm going to be using a wheelchair, how am I going to reach the taps? Those kinds of things. But when you see it and you feel it, you understand it.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for those great answers. This one
I just,
is for...
I just want to add a quick plug for Jonathan's classes. I've taken one. I really enjoyed it, learned a lot. So highly encourage people to do it. And hopefully, you know, Jonathan, this maybe inspires University of Buffalo to create some new certifications and some new programs.
Yeah, I hope so. It's a process going through soon to get a certificate. program. But yeah, it, you know, especially when it's all online. But now after the pandemic, a lot of things had moved online, and so maybe that'll become easier for us.
Yeah, like I do live tours of my house all of the time, and I just put my laptop on my lap, and you get to like travel around in my house with me, and it's not the same as being here, but it's almost the same.
Wonderful. And if I may also encourage everyone who is here with us, Gustavo has started a wonderful new community. It's the Enable Disabled Chat. And it's a fantastic community. I'm going to ask my team to please just drop that link on the chat. Gustavo, would you like to talk about your community a little bit?
Yep. So we just started this community, and I think this is, for people watching this, this is a great place to come and continue the conversation with Jonathan and Julie and some of the other panelists later this month to, you know, ask more questions. Let's learn together, engage, and let's see, you know, let's build something vibrant, something where we can share knowledge, where we can amplify each other's work and learn about the things that we want to know more about.
Definitely. Thank you. Okay, so we have a few more minutes and a couple more questions. Jonathan, really quick, can you give the name of the town in Sweden in the photo?
I believe it is Malmo, M-A-L-M-O. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that correctly. Either that, if it's not that, it's Lund, but I think it's Malmo.
Okay.
My note under one of the images says Malmo, but I know I've gotten it wrong in the past, so I'm pretty sure it's Malmo.
Awesome. Now, when you were talking about that, there was a comment and another one of your photos, the one about the station where you said, "Well, I don't know how it is in New York," but somebody commented, it is very slippery when wet. And then you went on to talk about all this. So I just wanted to acknowledge that, you know,
it did look like it could be. It had a lot of glare on the floor, as I recall, but it also had big barricades and walls up. And so I couldn't, you know, really get a feel for it.
Wow.
When I was there, but yeah, the purpose of the example was to show, like, look, it's very iconic. We're spending a lot of money on this transit stop. And somebody else had mentioned, you know, yeah, but other transit stops don't have, you know, bathrooms, you know, so, you know, bathrooms, I would say, are more important than you know, making it, you know, this grand gesture. How many of those little fit, you know, whale bones could have been removed to put bathrooms someplace, you know, in a different station somewhere, right? You know, so it's all about these values. Not saying it's not important to have, I mean, this is the first stop people come, they come down, it's at World Trade Center, you know, sure, it's important to have an iconic feature. I'm not saying it's bad to do that. I'm just saying you can choose your priorities.
Absolutely. All right. So on to our last question from Eve. Early in the presentation, the issue of cost was brought up as a primary concern to inclusive design. I think it's important to have tools and training to preemptively and responsibly address value over cost, including the fact that when we design for everyone, everyone benefits, for which I'm sure most inclusive or universal designers have uncountable examples. How do designers, architects, and planners overcome stigma associated with inclusive design costs and disability, turning it into a unique selling proposition or a strength or value proposition while focusing on the goals of the project at hand?
Well, so I think this is where it really, you have to tie the other goals of the project, whatever that is, with universal design goals and say, you know, everybody wants a building that's comfortable, that's, you know, promotes wellness or something like that, right? But let's say you're, you know, you're a YMCA and it's a fitness center, right? It's all about wellness, right? So you can really lean into that. And so it's about combining your goals and making sure you're having that. In terms of the training, it's important, you know, we now include this, the little bit that I gave you, and we've got a whole section. One of the courses on our on that UD education site now is on that. It goes into more detail and shows some more examples. Idea 316 is the course that's got a lot more on that as well. And we now include that anytime we talk to both designers and especially clients, and we give what we call the business case for universal design, going over all of those things that that we talked about here, but also, you know, about broadening the market, brand, social branding, saying, you know, we're being socially responsible in terms of branding, which is in with a lot of companies now these days. You know, you want to say, oh, we're welcoming, we're being inclusive, here's how we're doing that. And so you can sort of sell it that way. I wouldn't say cost is necessarily a stigma. I wouldn't use that phrase, but I would say that, you know, it is a hindrance in terms of getting people on board. And so you have to sort of educate both the client and the design team, because sometimes the clients just look to the design team to be the expert. So both sort of need to know, no, this can actually help you, because it helped you save costs on this, right? If somebody's looking at doing something sustainable, the architecture firm might say, hey, why don't you use this? Because, it'll save you money in the long run. They need to be able to do the same thing with universal design. So we try to provide that training to them.
My answer to that would be to make it personal.
That works too.
Right. When you talk to anybody, they will have somebody in their life that will benefit from universal design in a space or accessibility in a space. And when you point that out in a polite, you know, non-confrontational, loving kind of way, then it helps people change their perspective and their way of thinking. Yeah, I would want my uncle to be able to come on this trip with us and go to all of these places, right? Or come to this restaurant, or get into that YMCA and work his tail off in a fit way that works for him, kind of thing, right? Like, I'm a storyteller, and that's what I do in my stories, is I make it personal, and I make people see, I think I make people see how to just tweak things and think about everybody.
Yeah, that's great. You tell stories about your own family. You know, I'll tell stories about my mother had a lung transplant, and she ended up having to use a wheelchair for a while before she had the transplant. Or I'll talk about, you know, my daughter, you know, who's 6 years old now, but, you know, trying to navigate the world with her, and, you know, going on trips and potty training and all that. You know, these are things that resonate with a lot of people. And so you can tell any number of stories about, you know, to make it personal, and somebody's going to, you know, resonate. It'll resonate with somebody.
Absolutely. Well, I want to thank all of you, but this has been absolutely fantastic. But do you have any parting pieces of knowledge that you want to leave us with, Gustavo, Julie, Jonathan?
I'll go first. I have one thing in mind. And Julie, you did tell a beautiful story on the podcast the first time you were on, the first of two, where two of your best friends, when you were, before you even came back from the hospital, had already built ramps in their homes because you were still Julie, you were still their friend, and they wanted you to feel welcome in their home. So I think that's just to me, the question I ask is, if we can make things better, why aren't we? We have the tools, we have the technology, we have the expertise. So that's the question that you have to ask yourself as a business owner, as a human being, as a leader of a corporation or an organization. If we can make things better for more people, why aren't we?
And to build on that, it seems overwhelming. If you are a business owner and you're like, oh, I got to make my space better, pick one thing and do it, right? Jonathan said he has a list, right? Pick one thing off of Jonathan's list and do it. And it just gets you over, it's like anything, right? Like exercising, do one push-up. Don't just start with 1,000 push-ups, right? Do one thing, and it will help you see that it is possible. And sometimes it's, from an accessibility perspective, it's those low-hanging fruit that are not super expensive and really do make a big difference. So that would be my thing. Pick one thing and commit to it and do it.
Wonderful. Yeah, and it could be something easy, like you said, it could be signs, you know, or you start with something like that, or it could be something you want to fix anyway, something that's been problematic or that broke and you got to fix anyway. Oh, this, you know, this counter has got a wonky door on it and it's all busted and I got to put in a new counter. I'm going to put in a right height counter for this. Or say, you know, maybe some people just update styles as time goes on and you know what, my restaurant bathrooms are outdated. I'm going to redo them. Let me redo them right. Mm-hmm. You know, so there's lots of ways of doing that. But yeah, think about, you know, that value over the long term, and you know, what you can actually get from that, you know, down the line. We all do this just in our everyday life, trying to make sure that we're doing the right thing. And, you know, but how can we make sure that we're, you know, increasing value, you know, when people have a positive experience someplace, they come back, they want to come back. And that's really the biggest thing. And so you're always constantly thinking, how can I get people to come back and have a positive experience here? And, you know, maybe sometimes that has to deal with the fundamentals of the business, make sure the food tastes good or make sure it's got good service. But it could also be the place itself. It's warm, it's welcoming, it's inviting. For everybody. And so how are we making sure that, and just make sure that you're expanding your concept of warm and inviting to people who maybe you don't know, people who use a wheelchair, who have, you know, a child with a disability or who are bringing some older, you know, person to the store who, you know, is with them, who has kids with them or whatever it is, that you might not be personally familiar with.
I love that. And on the topic of how can I make them come back, I would love to invite everyone to come back next week for the wonderful continuation of the series that we have. I'm going to ask the team to please drop the links on the chat right now for the programs that we have coming, and also to invite everyone to continue this conversation in Gustavo's community. And if the team could please drop also Gustavo's information in the chat, that would be fantastic. It's on the document that we have, so that everybody can just move over there. We can continue with this conversation and we can continue creating a better environment for all of us and for all of the ones that we love. So thank you again, a million, Julie, Jonathan, Gustavo. This has been so wonderful. Thank you to each and everyone who stayed with us. I know that we went over for a few minutes, but I know that it was certainly worth it for me, hopefully worth it for you. Please give us your feedback. I'm going to ask the team to drop the feedback form as well. Let us know what we did well, what we could improve upon, and I will see you next Monday in here. Have a wonderful week, everyone. And again, thank you so, so much. This was an awesome kickoff of the series. Take care. Thank you, everyone. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Bye.